John Fay, another edition of the CDOT podcast. Thank you very much. Coming up on the CDOT is my guest, Dan Levitt, who wrote the book In Pursuit of Penance, which is about general managers, history of it, and all this, that kind of thing, and how the job has evolved over time. It's an interesting read, an interesting conversation, so we'll do that. But first I have John Fay, my fellow Reds beat writer. We're sitting here in lovely Goodyear, Arizona. And we're about halfway. Is it halfway?
We're farther. Well, yeah, right. Yeah. As we record this, we're one day and 3 weeks from opening day.
1 day and 3 weeks, which seems like a long time. It seems like really close.
Yeah, I think it'll go fast. It's kind of started to drag a little bit now, but because they have to do a lot. They still have 54 players in camp.
Yeah.
So they have to cut more than half of them. They got to cut 29 guys. And they have some big decisions to make.
I don't know how many big decisions there are.
Well, I think there's some with the bullpen.
That's where I think that could be the most interesting decisions. And we'll talk a little bit about that.
I threw out a 25-man roster today, and I didn't have Kevin Gregg on it. Kevin Gregg's pitched pretty well. He's been very good. I think Rafael Iglesias and Michael Lorenzen will make it.
I do, too.
So somebody's going to have to be out. I didn't have Jay Hoover making it. They're high. They're still high on JJ, higher than the fans are. But he's given.
That's not tough.
Yeah, but he's given up 2 home runs and 4 appearances, and that was the big thing with him last year, giving up home runs. So, you know, I think that would be a hard decision for them. He has options,
and that's the big thing.
And I just don't think. I think they need to get off to a good start, and I don't think they can afford to let him work things out up here. They can let him work it out in Louisville. If he gets back to being JJ, there'll be a spot for him. So I think there's some interesting decisions because they also have to get a lot of guys on the roster.
Right, and that's where it always comes in is when you start, you know, the non-roster guys because we're just saying, I mean, Lorenzen is not on the 40.
He's not on the 40, man. Iglesias is.
Iglesias is because he signed that big league deal.
And
Brennan Bosch.
Is not on. And I think he definitely makes it. I think everybody's.
Say someone like Jason Marquis is not on. Paul Mahal, same thing. I think it's an either or at this point.
Yeah.
But still, I mean, you're still talking one of those guys that's a roster spot.
Right.
The bullpen, let's just go through it. I mean, the bullpen, we have 7 guys. So you have Chapman.
Burke Badenhop.
I mean, those two.
Yeah. Jumbo Diaz. Manny Parra.
Sam LaCure.
And
then Lorenzen and Iglesias.
Right. So they'd have to get one spot there.
One spot there. Rotation, you need one spot.
Right.
And those are 40-man spots, not 25. You know, the DL doesn't.
They've got a spot with Jason Bourgeau getting hurt. He'll probably start the season on the 60-day disabled.
And Sean Marshall.
Right. So they put those two guys on the
60-man. That helps. Those are those spots. But then you still have Bosch and maybe either Dominguez.
He's on, right?
I don't think, no. He's a minor league deal.
Okay, yeah. I think it's something that they fret over a little bit, but I rarely see guys taken off the 40-man, and then you think, oh, my God, they lost him. It usually works itself out.
Last year one of those guys was Ishmael Guillen, and they hold on to him. Yeah. End of the season, off the 40-man, he's back here.
The guy who's on Lamar. That I think probably might get picked up or might not, but Juan Duran.
There's just so much power there. Power is becoming so scarce.
Yeah.
And that guy, when he stings the ball, he can sting it. And, you know, it might hurt because this is someone they put some money into initially. But is he going to be a big league player?
Yeah.
I mean, you look at him, and you look at Yorman, and, I mean, sure, there's more upside for Juan Duran, but he doesn't have the baseball skills that Yoermann Rodriguez has.
Yeah, Yoermann's much closer. So, yeah, I think they'll figure out how to work it out. And I do think, and Brian Price has said this, they got to really try to get the best 25 men, because I think a good start is just paramount with this team. I really, you know, they're not picked to do anything, and that doesn't matter in the scheme of things, but I think as far as confidence to come out of the gate well would really help this team.
Well, it also helps Brian Price with Bob Castellini.
Yeah, Brian has two more years on his contract, but I think he has to have – they have to be a lot better this year than they were last year just because they
– It has to show something.
Right. And they took a step back. And the good news for them so far in camp is they've had some little minor injuries, but two of those guys were back, Billy Hamilton and Devin Mesoraco, and missed time. Jay Bruce missed a little time, but the main guys have been healthy, and I think Joey Votto, just judging from how much he's played and everything, he's fine. So
yeah, I had somebody email me yesterday. It's like, well, what's really wrong with Votto? And I'm like, well, you don't do that when he's played three of the last 4 days. I mean, that's kind of an odd thing. I mean, one of those days was a B day, B game, so that kind of gets lost. And then
I watched the B game. He played. I think he played seven innings.
You had video of it.
Yeah.
You had video of a double.
Yeah. I think he's – the thing about him is he never had good early springs. He's the kind of guy that works on things early and then he gets locked in. I think he'll probably be able to do that this spring. And the fact that when he didn't play the first four games, everybody was all worried about it, but – if they'd kept him out of workouts, I think that would have been a concern. They haven't done any of that.
No, I mean, because that's the thing. It's like when he wasn't in the lineup opening day, we said, hey, is Joey, because he had gone through all the workouts. And we'd seen him, like, you know, I had video of him of going around the bases full speed. I wasn't there, I guess, watching when they did sliding drills, and that's one of the things they held him out of. But I mean, that was the kind of stuff. So he was doing... Unless you're watching every minute and keeping a tally, which we don't exactly do.
And I think one thing that people is kind of lost when you're not here, but today was a camp day for him. I was out there before I went over to Mesa, and he was hitting the cages. Guys can get a lot more done when they don't play.
Yes.
I mean, there's certain things.
Reporters, too.
Right. There's certain things they want to do. They want them to be out there for seven innings on their feet and kind of build up and all that. But as far as working on hitting and stuff, you can get a lot more done staying back. So I think, you know, generally they've been pretty healthy. Sean Marshall's a disappointment. I didn't think they could count on him to begin with because shoulder injuries are so hard to come back. And it just seems like every time we talk about him, there's something else has happened. And you really feel for the guy. It's just it's very difficult. I just know through the years to come back from shoulder. Elbows are completely different. Guys, they have Tommy John, and they're in a year they're fine. So
right. So it's kind of interesting. I mean, Marshall, I guess there were like signs of optimism, but I mean, when you're dealing with shoulder injuries, it's always and that's why, like, even with Tony Cingrani, he's pitched well. Brian said that the velocity is increasing and all that, but. I mean, it wasn't shoulder surgery, so there's a difference between rehabbing a shoulder injury and then when they cut.
Yeah, and there's a big difference between being 23 or 24 like he is and 33 or 34 like Marshall is.
Marshall has money in the bank.
Yeah, not that he's not making the effort to come back.
No. I was just saying, the physical differences for the 23, 24-year-old, Yeah. I'll take my chances with 34 and that kind of money in the bank already, even if you don't pitch again and you have something to fall back on.
Yeah, so I think for the most part it's been a pretty good camp for him.
It's been boring.
Yeah, that's what you want. Last year there was a lot of stuff happening, you know.
Yeah, we'd never had to search for a lead note.
Right, and the thing with they had the two openings in the rotation, now three, because Homer Bailey's going to miss one or two starts. They're finally saying that definitively. But none of those guys has pitched bad. Marquis's been unbelievable. He retired 17 in a row at one point and has only given up.
His biggest problem was not being able to pitch in the stretch.
Right. And Anthony DeSclafani's been very good. David Holmberg's been very good. Mahomes been very good.
Holmberg's a guy who just keeps getting lost.
Yeah, yeah. You know, I.
Because when they got him a year plus, they said this is a guy who could be a five for us right now. And they didn't need it because their fifth starter was better. Was probably the best fifth starter around.
Right.
And Mike Leake. I mean.
Yeah.
Right now, it was Tony Cigrani last year, so.
And then it became Alfredo Simon.
So he was an all-star.
Yeah, they did go through a few, but yeah, I think they could live with any of those guys. I picked Marquis to make it. I just think he's been the best. He has that history with Walt Jocketty, which you can't discount. And he's coming off of Tommy John surgery, but the year before when he was healthy with San Diego, he pitched pretty well. It wouldn't surprise me if it's Mahomes because he's left-handed. They have some choices there where, you know, to get those guys in and to add a little depth, I think they really helped themselves.
Mahomes, if it's Mahomes, when was the last time they had two left-handed starters in the rotation?
I can't. It's been a while. It's been a long while because they went so long with no left-handers. So. And I think there's a slight chance that they see Cingrani as a reliever and go with Mahomes because the way the bullpen's set up right now, it's one left-hander with
Parra.
Well, one situational left-hander, Chapman,
right.
Obviously. But, I think they're not scrambling to try to find guys to fill spots. They have some depth. That said, none of those guys is Matt Latos, or you can't count on him being as good, but they do have some. I think
if Homer's healthy, that top three, and then you always look at it, you have four or five starters. I mean, Paul Mahomes was the fifth starter for the Dodgers last year.
Yeah.
And how much money did they have up in their rotation with Rue, Greinke, Kershaw? I mean,
and Tony Cingrani, when he's healthy, was very good as a rookie. So. If they can get him back to where he was, I think they got a chance to have a decent rotation, especially when you have the three up front and a true ace, which, you know, they've been looking for forever.
Well, and everybody looks for it. You know, I've had this discussion. It's kind of almost a running joke with Andy McCullough, who covers the Royals for the Kansas City Star. And the joke is, like, how many aces are there? Like, every time we get together, there's somebody new, and we have this discussion. We were with Tyler Kepner and of the New York Times, and Tyler just says, like, 15. And both Andy are like, name them, 15. And you can't name 15 aces in baseball. Andy's a little stingier than most, saying there's, like, seven. And I tend to think it's about 10 to 12. I mean, it might not even be that many right now.
It was funny. I was talking to Bronson Arroyo for a story and talk to him about Cueto, and Bronson said he thought one third of the teams have an ace. I think that's about
right. So
it's 10. Yeah, 10. And, you know, I think to be an ace, one, you got to do it for a number of years, and Johnny Cueto has done that.
Right.
I think people would put the kid from Cleveland,
Kluber
in there, but he's only, you know.
You
got to do it again.
And really good, and I kind of want to see it again. I mean, and that's. You know, like, you know, there are guys who could do it, like Matt Harvey or Jose Fernandez. But, you know, Tanaka even with the Yankees. I mean, he's got, 16 big league starts?
Yeah.
He's got great stuff. And the only guy, and this is what we kind of came up with, the one guy who's different is Chris Sale. Just because when Sale's pitching, he's unhittable. He can be unhittable.
Well, I think the thing with that, I think the innings are so important. Cueto is going to give you seven most of the time and eight a lot of the time. And if you can hold a team down to one or two runs over that, you know, his ERA was 2.25, you're going to give your team a chance to win every night. And he prides himself on that. He threw a lot of innings last year, and I think that was a question on him was health, and he proved it last year. If he's healthy again this year, he's going to get a lot of money from somebody.
Yeah. And I guess that's kind of the last question to camp, because he said, you know, once opening day comes in, because we talk about position battles, we're talking about the back end of the bench, talking about the back end of the rotation and the back end of the bullpen.
Yeah, it's funny every year in spring training, everybody's talking about, you know, we're talking about Chris Dominguez and Brandon Bosch and stuff. And they could have a big role, but if everybody's healthy, those the it's incidental what those guys do.
Roger Bernardino.
Yeah, I mean, we made such a big deal out of him. And he was great in spring training. He came up. He didn't do much.
The other thing is, guys like that, they play a lot in spring training. And that's different than being a bench player in the big leagues.
Right. Today, for instance, Brandon Bosch was in, and he was playing in the ninth inning. So he was probably facing, I don't know who he was facing. I wasn't paying close enough attention, but probably somebody who's not going to make the team. And that's where the spring training stats can get skewed. It's a lot of times when you play, you'll see that with relievers particularly. They'll come in the third or fourth inning in games, so they face the starting lineup and things like that. But one of the interesting things today was the Reds were getting shut out in the ninth inning. Ivan DeJesus Jr. doubled in a run. He was on second. Brandon Bosch singled. They sent DeJesus. Jim Ringelman sent DeJesus, and he got thrown out by a lot. So instantly on Twitter, we got some Steve Smith. And that's one of those deals where when you're watching it, it's like, oh, you shouldn't send him, but it's the bottom of, or the ninth inning of a one-run game. Make the guy make a throw.
Right.
But the guy made a throw.
And nobody wanted to stick around any longer anyway.
Right. It was their chance to tie, which would have got them to 5-5-3. So,
and also forced them to use another pitcher in the bottom of the inning because it was in Pesa and maybe even go 10, and nobody really wants to go 10. Jim Robleman might have had plans.
Yeah, yeah.
Spring training is a different animal.
Right. It's that's the thing I was talking to someone yesterday. It seems like they're much more willing to play ties now. I can remember, you know, 10 years ago when I started this, they would always go extra innings, you know, maybe one or two at the most, but they would go. Now, somebody said, I can't remember what team, they have like four ties. So it's a new thing in spring training, lots of ties.
Well, I mean, don't want to put too many innings out there.
Right, well, and the way it works, most of the time they have, today they had five pitchers to pitch, four of them, Cueto, and then four of them are going to pitch one inning, and that's all they're going to, they didn't have anybody else. They're going to play nine, and that's it.
And then Ted Powers' son-in-law did it to the Reds again.
Chris DeNorfia. Well, that was the only hit they had. They had one hit.
It's a two-run homer.
And, you know, Cueto, talking to him afterwards, he said, pitching against the Cubs, he says, no, I can't pitch the way I ordinarily do against the Cubs because he's going to see them. And,
that's interesting. So, I mean, the Cubs and Brewers, they see a lot.
Yeah.
They're out here. You have the Cardinals and the Pirates over in Florida. Yeah.
Well, the strange thing out here this year, there's just a schedule quirk. The Reds don't go to Peoria at all.
I was thinking about that today when I was driving up to my wife and daughter out here, so we went to go see a movie, and we were kind of driving up that way, and I was like, I haven't been to Peoria yet. And
yeah, they don't go. So they play Seattle in Goodyear, but they
– in San Diego, too.
Yeah, that's which you think would be two teams they'd want to play because they don't see them as much. But they've gone to Mesa twice, and they go to Merrydale twice. But, I don't know why. It's not a huge deal, but you'd think you'd want to avoid –
maybe they just wanted to avoid Bell Road because Bell Road traffic around game time can be really a pain in the butt. That's really what's important in spring training.
The great thing was we went to Mesa today, but we went on a Sunday. So traffic was not bad, which is unusual when you're going all the way across Phoenix.
Right, and everybody was kind of going across traffic with you since the race was out here.
Right, yeah.
The NASCAR race, and I'm sorry that I let you miss that.
Yeah, I think if I was going the other way, I'd still be on the road. There was some traffic.
So, anyway, speaking of going into Phoenix, I actually went to the Sabre Analytics Conference the other day, caught up with Dan Levitt, and here's our discussion with Dan.
Oh, cool. Yeah, I'm recording. Yeah. So,
all right.
here with Dan Levitt, or except Daniel L. Levitt on the R. I'm sorry, Daniel R. Levitt on the book cover. The book is In Pursuit of Penance, Baseball Operations from Dead Ball to Moneyball. You know what's funny is, like, before PR people reached out to me, I'd been reading the blog, and I found that so interesting, the ranking of the top 25 general managers of all time. And it's just kind of, it's funny because, you know, the Baseball Abstract came out, the first one, the Historical Abstract came out how many years ago, and we had the players, and, you know, and that's such a great book from Bill James, and changed some thinkings about some things, but nobody seemed to have done it with the guys who now seem to be almost the most important, and to some people even more important than the players, it seems, and that's the general managers. Is that where this came? I mean, how did this come about, this project come about?
Well, Mark and I have always been interested in team building and how teams were put together. Both of us have done several books, but the first book we actually wrote was together back in 2003, and it was called Paths to Glory, and it was about how teams were put together. And so that, our interest has always been in team building, and as we finished up this book, Pursuit of Penance, we thought there was an opportunity to, as a way to sort of get a little press around this book, to rank GMs. We'd spent, you know, basically 15 years of our life researching GMs, and we realized that there hadn't actually been anyone who tried to put it together and say, well, here, you know, let's rank these. And so we thought it'd be fun to do, and we got a pretty good reception. So that worked out pretty nicely that we did. I mean, it did hit resonate with people, which was fun for us. The other thing is that there's no good defined criteria for how you rank a GM. You know, with a shortstop, you can sort of compare Barry Larkin to Honus Wagner, at least in some sense of context of time, but every GM has a different charge. You know, some are coming in and building a team from scratch, and some are taking over an already built team and trying to get him to the championship. So it's an interesting dynamic there.
Where do you start? Do you just, like, go, okay, well, here's 30 through 1 through 30 now, and then, like, there's just so many, and finding these kind of things. Where do you start? It seems almost overwhelming because you're talking about this history of baseball, and it's not like GMs have always been celebrated as they are now.
Right. Well, absolutely. At one point, GMs were much more like, especially in the 60s, were like a team president, where a guy like Jim Campbell in Detroit or Bob Housman in Cincinnati were almost like ran the whole organization, as opposed to just sort of the baseball ops side, which they do today. You know, where you start, you just start figuring out who all these GMs were and who won and you know, who gets credit for what. You know, some teams, they may have had four GMs that have added players to a team that finally wins a World Series, so you have to try and figure out how to apportion credit as well, and how much credit does a GM get for the draft picks versus, you know, scouting directors. So it's just, it's a complicated, subjective thing, but, you know, we tried to weigh various factors, and it was just a lot of fun.
So I know Bob Housman was number four in the ranking? That's, and that guy's not in the Hall of Fame.
He should be. He built the big red machine, and he also was on the Cardinals in the mid-60s and helped sort of keep that team together. He helped transition the 64 team to the team that won in 67 and 68. So he's got a great resume.
Are GMs underrepresented in the Hall of Fame?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, depending on who you count as a GM versus did they get in for being a baseball, you know, a league president or with GM.
Right.
I mean, but they're somewhere between 5 and 7. I mean, the guys that were clearly only in as GMs are guys like George Weiss of the Yankees, Ed Barrow of the Yankees, Larry McPhail, although he was also an owner,
right.
Branch Rickey, and then most recently Pat Gillick, who got in 2011.
It just seems like that's...
I agree.
The sad thing is, I remember, who was I talking to? I was like, because the lead up to the Hall of Fame, because they just announced it at the winter meetings on that one. And I was like, I know this is stupid, but I don't think that Bob's going to get in. Because, you know, for me, I had two stories written.
Right.
And that's what you have to do for a newspaper. I had one to get in. And actually, I didn't even think about him getting in. I was pretty sure. I was betting way too much, more than I should have, that he wasn't. So I had that one written. I was like, and I was talking to Jay Jaffe, and Jay's like, you know, he's got to get in. And Jay is somebody I respect so much when it comes to the Hall of Fame. And I was like, oh crap, I have 15 minutes to write a Bob Housman's in the Hall of Fame story that I can go with, and I had like two browsers open ready. But yet, then like the announcing comes, you got like fewer than three of the votes.
Yeah, it's sad. Although I think, I mean, I was reading a couple of blogs where the voting, based on the number of votes that people could cast, it was, you could, there was like 12 voters and they could each only vote for four. So the, it was a skewed thing that way too. But you're right. I for only to get three votes, I think is, you know, is a little bit strange.
What made Bob Housem stand out? I mean, that he's the fourth best GM of all time. I mean, Big Red Machine, of course, the results on the field show it. But what was it? What was it about Bob Housem that, that made him so good at that job?
One thing, he was incredibly thorough. He basically made sure that his staff understood every other team in the National League as well as that team did. So he was incredibly thorough. So when he was going to make trades like the Joe Morgan trade, he would go to the GM of the Houston Astros and say, "Here's what I think you need." And at the time, with some of these GMs were a little less sophisticated, they would listen to that. And it wasn't being disingenuous. I mean, he was honestly saying, "Here's what I think you need, and here's what we like." And so, well, for one thing, he outworked and was incredibly thorough. He also had a team of scouts working with him that he relied on very heavily, almost like Pat Gillick, where he almost had scouts and executive levels within his organization.
How common was that at the time?
Not particularly. Not super common. Most teams had sort of the scouting staff, but they didn't necessarily rely on their farm director and their scouting director the same way that Housem did. He also always tried to, in his trades, you know, he always tried to get a throw in, and he always tried to get younger. And you know, he scouted well enough that he could do that. You know, obviously the classic bad trade of that was the Frank Robinson trade, where, you know, Bill DeWitt traded Frank Robinson away, you know, a year too early as opposed to a year too late, and it was a disaster. He had 10 more good years, or 6 more good years of baseball. But if you do that right, and you can sort of not do it with your superstars, it's generally a pretty good strategy. So those were a couple of the things that just, but his organizational thoroughness, he really built an organization. And one of the things we talk about in the book is the importance of an organization. You know, Jacob Rupert with the Yankees, he really built the first organization. He had Ed Barrow as his general manager, and that was one of the first GMs ever in baseball, that concept. And so Housem's, what Housem did really better than anybody else was build an organization.
When did it turn to the GM as we know it today?
The evolution of the GM was pretty much, the position came into effect in the 20s. It sort of grew until you got to the 60s and the 70s, where you had the GM really being the focus of the organization and having both sort of the front and back office under him. Again, a guy like Jim Campbell in Detroit, or Bob Housem, or Joe Brown in Pittsburgh, just sort of overall guys almost acting as president and reporting directly to the owner. And then as baseball continued to get more and more complicated, on the business side, especially with the incoming of free agency, but you had, you know, the souvenirs and the clothing and just all of the stuff coming. You really needed a whole lot more. So teams would insert pretty much a president, you know, in between the owner and the baseball operations side, who also ran everything else in the organization. And that really started coming in the 80s. Even a guy like Pat Gillick ended up reporting to a president, Paul Beeston in Toronto. Basically today you have the GM really running just the baseball operations side, and that was sort of an evolution through the 80s and the 90s.
So, I mean, this is a relatively recent development when you look at the history of baseball. For so long, it was such a different job than it is now. Do the new guys have it easier or harder?
Well, I mean, I think baseball today is probably as competitive as it's ever been. There was sort of a, when you were a GM in the 60s, unless you were really terrible, you probably had a job for a while because you were kind of the owner's pal and you were working with them. Today it's pretty cutthroat. You know, you got to win, and everybody has a smart GM, and everybody pretty much has a lot of money. That being said, you don't have to worry about all the other parts of the operation as well.
It's such an interesting, I mean, because you think about just the size of an organization now, where it was even, you know, 20 years ago. All the people underneath and the specialization and, you know, it just, it's kind of fascinating how the evolution of the front office through the you know, just the levels that you have.
Well, that's one of the themes of the book, and it is interesting because even, you're right, even you had maybe a GM, you had a scouting director, a farm director, you know, a couple assistants maybe under that, and you know, you maybe had, you know, 6 or 8 people in the baseball op group in the 80s, and today it's, you know, 40.
Yeah.
You know, and in the 20s, when Branch Rickey was running the Cardinals, he had Bill DeWitt as his assistant and treasurer. He had a guy who's a traveling secretary and 2 actual secretaries, and that was it. You know, so it's definitely morphed.
I mean,
over
more
the
than
years.
That travels now.
Right.
A lot of times on the road.
Right. Yeah. I mean, you couldn't possibly do all the travel with one guy either anymore. I mean, it's just everything's just gotten so much more complex, and it's just such a lot more larger business than it was when you had to just put 25 guys on the train and get them from one town to another.
So would Branch Rickey or Bob Houseman still be successful today?
Well, I think so. I mean, I think that both of the, I mean, well, let me put this way, Bob Houseman after 1976 sort of retired because he knew that he wasn't going to be successful under free agency. He was one of the original guys, you know, putting his finger in the dike to try and stop free agency from happening. So after free agency, obviously the Reds, you know, tumbled and didn't really know how to deal with free agency and the team.
Some would argue that hasn't changed.
Yeah. So I don't know so much about Houseman. I think Rickey was just an incredible man and would have been successful.
Was he number one?
He was number one. I mean, you know, he invented, I mean, besides the Jackie Robinson thing,
putting aside changing the course of American history.
Exactly.
He also
invented the farm system, which was the other major thing. I mean, one of the things we talk about, the other sort of theme besides the changing nature of front offices is just sort of how there are these key moments in baseball where you either respond to changes or create changes, or you sort of, and then that's how you create a true long-term dynasty or winning streak, if you will. You know, whether, so like Moneyball to us, the whole analytics revolution is one of many things that has happened in baseball history, whether it was the invention of the general manager in the 20s or the farm system in the 30s or Rickey, you know, deciding that, gee, we're going to go find African-American players in the 40s, which completely changed the balance of power in the National League because you opened up this whole new group of players that can now play baseball. In the 60s, you had the draft, and the draft completely changed the way teams could build themselves. You couldn't just go sign as many good amateurs as you wanted to anymore. And that completely changed it. And you saw in 1965, new teams taking over from old teams because of that. In the 70s, free agency, and how do teams respond to that? So part of the other theme of our book is how either teams created these opportunities, took advantage of them, or sort of fell by the wayside when they came.
I mean, it's almost, you always have to be looking ahead and how you're, like, I mean, I'm sure there are a lot of front offices right now looking at, well, how are we going to deal with Cuba, or how are we going to do with a worldwide draft, and that's going to be the next change. I mean, those are probably 2 of the next changes.
Right. I mean, you see people looking everywhere for players now. Curacao's got a bunch of guys in the major leagues. So it's looking for new spots, and it's also looking for new opportunities. This whole marrying of high-tech, you know, video technology with high-speed computing, where you can now sort of measure the ball coming off the bat or what pitchers are doing, and so you all of a sudden don't have to sort of worry so much about, is that ball a hit? You can measure the exact impact of what's going on at the it. So there's a lot of stuff going on, and I think teams are, again, I mean, we're at the analytics conference, and there's lots of smart people out there trying to come up with the next thing.
Right. It, you know, I'm looking at one of the smart people that they're, I'm not going to mention names because of proprietary things, but I see, like, you know, the Pirates are one of those smart things, and I see a guy standing next to us, a friend of mine, who is, like, on the cutting edge of doing something different, and that always fascinates me, is how these teams are going to figure it out, and who's going to be the first, and we've seen, I guess, that the Pirates and the A's is kind of, it's funny to think that's old now. Billy Beane's old.
You're right.
Where was Billy Beane in the rankings? Was he in the top 25?
Yeah, I think we actually had him at 11. I don't remember specifically. But, you know, Bill, he won a lot of division championships. And so another part of problem of ranking is how much credit do you give people for getting to the postseason but not winning the world championship, right? I mean, at some point, you have to win, but on the other hand, how much do you penalize someone? So,
and that's the funny thing is, like, you know, the Billy Bean famously is that it's just luck once you get the postseason. And I don't know that recent postseasons haven't proven him correct. I mean, just think of this last one. You know, you have the not only are two wild card teams, but one that was down 10-6, and you know, or whatever they were in the AL wild card.
Yeah, the seventh inning they were ahead.
Yeah, they were down, and it was like, oh yeah, they're firing the manager, firing everybody, and then oh, they turn around, they go, they're swinging the bat away from winning the World Series, and then, I mean, Brian Sabian. Can you explain Brian Sabian and his success?
Well, we actually talked a little bit about the Giants in the book. We think Sabian's a really good general manager, and had him right around number 15 in the rankings. We also talk a lot about Bill Newcomb, who became their managing general partner in 2008. And Newcomb really sort of recreated an organizational structure. They had the Giants had not come off well in the steroids report for Congress, and or for that Selig commissioned, and he really sort of recreated an organization there, and stressed excellence, and he and the team really their sense that the front office really responded to that. Sabian made a number of really good trades. They rebuilt the offense a couple of times with relatively unknown, inexpensive, available players. They also spent a lot of time on how to prevent pitching injuries, and actually in both 2010 and 2012, their first two World Series teams were uniquely good in being able to prevent pitching injuries.
Then last year they have pitching injuries, and then luckily Madison Bumgarner has just this magical month. Like, how do you, I'm going to get the guy who gets magical month. Who's that?
Yeah, that's right. That needs a little more statistical work, right?
Yeah, it still kills me. It's just like, here they were. And if Hurdle doesn't decide that he thinks that he can beat Johnny Cueto and Adam Wainwright can lose to force a one-game playoff, and that was more important than saving Garrett Cole to start the wild. I mean, these things are like, but yet that reflects on the Pirates front office that they don't have Garrett Cole to start that game because they wanted to start him to try to, it just blows my mind the little tiny things that can change. And it changes, baseball history.
Right?
It's unbelievable. Yeah. Then you also had, very high, I believe, was it 14, Walt Jocketty?
Yeah, he really did a nice job in St. Louis. I mean, he took over a team there that was sort of mediocre going along, and it's funny, Walt Jocketty is maybe one of the last guys that has not really very analytically inclined, but is still able to be pretty successful. Even today in Cincinnati, the team has been relatively successful in getting to the postseason, but in St. Louis, Jocketty made a number of great midseason trades. He made a number of great trades. He really rebuilt the team a couple of times with free agents. In 2000, he really rebuilt that team, and he would make changes on the fly and manage to sign pretty good players without getting stuck with bad contracts and trade for guys at midseason that were he would trade prospects for veterans without really getting stuck with bad contracts and guys that did well. I mean, I think he had several pennants in the one World Series. Mm-hmm. He was a good general manager.
Was?
Yes. I think in Cincinnati he's gonna get that team back. The team is sort of over concentrated on about four offensive guys, and if they're hurt, if the team's tough, but it's tough for the team. But
what with Walt, what do you see that sets him apart from other guys? I mean, you talk about those kind of things and maybe being the last of the non-analytic guy, but is there anything that you find with him that's different than everybody else? I mean, is there something you can put your finger on?
You know, it's hard with Walt to put your finger on. I mean, in one point in the book, we sort of talk about various ways that teams get ahead. It's creating a better organization, or it's taking advantage of one of these changes in the game, or it's creating a change in the game. And as we talk about with John McGraw, sometimes it's just kind of, you have a genius for a certain thing. And I think Jockety has just sort of had this genius for trading prospects for veterans, and he never seems to give up more than he gets. Most teams have been burned over the years by trading prospects for veterans, and in St. Louis he wasn't, and in Cincinnati, I mean, I think there's been a couple that haven't been quite as good as in St. Louis, but he just seems to have this knack for that trade, and I think he just has a group of really good scouts that he trusts. And especially in St. Louis, he had a good group of scouts that he trusted, and they, you know, they just did really well. I think sometimes you can just kind of do it that way, but it's, there's not anything that you can say, here's systematically what he did differently.
Right. You just look at the results over a period of time, like, right. Oh, he must have been doing something right.
Right.
What are some of your favorite stories in this book? I mean, what's the one that's just like, might blow somebody away that they would change their thinking sometimes?
Well, I don't know about changing their thinking. The trade when Gillick got Fred McGriff from the Yankees in the early 80s, I mean, it just sort of shows about how people look at trades. Gillick had Dale Murray as the pitcher that the Yankees wanted, and he had negotiated a trade for Dave Collins, the outfielder, and a pitcher, and he wanted McGriff, who was then in low A ball. And he went to, but he knew that if he asked for just McGriff, one more guy, he'd probably be told no. So he went and he said, I want either Don Mattingly or Dan Pasqua, who were both minor leaguers at the time. Mattingly was still fairly highly rated, and Pasqua was too, and he was also a kid from New Jersey, I think it was, and Steinbrenner liked keeping the local kids. And because he knew that Steinbrenner would tell him no on those two guys and probably offer him somebody else. And sure enough, Steinbrenner called back and said, look, we got to get this deal done. You can't have either of those guys, but you can have McGriff instead. And Gillick sort of played it coy, and he said, well, I don't really know if that'll work. I'll call you back in 15 minutes. And Gillick called back and said, all right, I'll take McGriff. And he got the guy that he wanted along.
McGriff was the guy he wanted all along?
Yeah.
Well, he probably knew Don Mattingly wasn't going to get it.
Right. Well, he knew he wasn't going to get both guys, or either
right.
guy, but
yeah.
that was just sort of part of the negotiating strategy. It just
Gillick's one of those guys, and you just—it's like sneaky good. You just
right.
think about where he was, and like, oh yeah, he was. Because I remember when he got in 2011, being at the winter meetings that year, and just like, oh yeah, Pat Gillick. You look at this resume, and it's like, oh my God, this guy did—he built several teams and was so good.
Well, Pat Gillick's motto was sort of was one of fish in many rivers. I mean, in other words, look for players everywhere. He was really the guy, or one of the two guys, who opened up the Dominican Republic in the early 80s. He was friends with Epi Guerrero, the great scout down there. He actually met him when they signed, when he was a scout with the Houston, and they signed Cesar Cedeno in 1967. And so he was great in the Rule 5 draft. So he was always looking for, he liked trying to sign multi sports stars, which didn't work out as well, but the whole Danny Ainge fiasco was something
right.
his, and I think he and Ainge still don't get along from the animosity from when Ainge jumped to Boston after the Celtics, after he
yeah.
didn't work out as a baseball player. So he his thing was, I'm going to try and find guys anywhere I can. I mean, he signed, when he was in Seattle, he signed Ichiro, and Ichiro
right.
was the first sort of successful.
That was a huge
yeah,
jump.
Yeah.
I mean, that was a huge risk, because he
right.
signed him to a lot of money, and
and no
yeah.
position player from Japan had been successful in the U.S. before.
Right. And
so.
You do that. I mean, and then you have time with the Phillies, you know, you
right.
built that team, built
right.
the Blue Jays. I mean,
one of the things he did, I mean, yeah. with the Blue Jays, besides what was, that team won 86 games or more 11 years in a row from 83 to 93. And that's an incredible feat. I mean, the Yankees, I mean, I don't know historically how rare it is, but. The Yankees may have done it in the 50s. I'm sure the Yankees did it in the 50s,
yeah.
but there's not a lot of teams that win at least 86 games 11 years in a row.
It's the Braves probably, well, there's that asterisk with 94. With
but
the
even
Braves.
So, yeah, but even that strike, I mean, allocated for the strike, yeah,
yeah.
They probably did it in there, but it's
yeah.
it's an incredibly hard thing to do.
And then Schierholz, I'm sure, was pretty high as well.
Right, we had Schierholz, I think, 6. You know, one of the things that Schierholz did that a lot of modern GMs don't, is he integrated his young guys into an already championship team, you know, as opposed to trading his prospects for stopgap. So, you know, he integrated Andrew Jones and Chipper Jones and Javi Lopez
right.
into teams that were already really the best in baseball. And we contrasted that with John Hart in Cleveland, who we also ranked, I think, in the low 20s, who was a great general manager. But, you know, he traded guys like Sean Casey and Danny Graves for guys that weren't really as, you know, that he might have, those guys might have been better solutions at some point than the guys that he actually brought in over
right.
the years.
And there's something to be said about keeping those guys,
right.
and that's probably even more important now because of the cost structure.
Right.
These guys all want to keep their young guys.
And the other thing is if you have a young guy that you know is going to be good for the next 5 or 10 years, or even, I mean, you think is good, it gives you one less problem to solve each year. If you bring
right.
in stopgap veterans every year or two, you got to solve that same problem. And there's only so many problems a GM can solve in an offseason. And so getting a core like Gillicat in Philadelphia, which he inherited, made his job in building that team easier because he didn't have to, like, he already had Chase Utley and Ryan Howard. And so if you can get that core, that makes your job a lot easier.
Right, and get them in young and
right.
while they're cost controlled.
Well, cool. Oh,
all right. Thanks. Well, I was wrapping up anyway,
okay.
So there you go. Dan, thank you so much for your time. I really appreciate it. It's fascinating. The book is In Pursuit of Pennants, Baseball Operations from Dead Ball to Moneyball. When is this? Is this out now?
It's officially out April 1. I think there's probably going to be available here in the next couple of weeks because
cool.
I think that's a late date.
So that's a very cool look at how baseball teams are built these days and how the they were built in the past and how all that's changed. Very cool. I really appreciate it, Dan. And thanks again.
My pleasure.
And then, thanks again for joining us. Hope you enjoyed that. We'll be back on I try to put these up Monday nights, Tuesday. You can get us on iTunes, Stitcher, SoundCloud, all your podcasting needs, Cincinnati.com. We put it up every Tuesday. If you could rate and review on iTunes, that really does help out somehow. I don't know how, but they tell me it does. And anything that tells my bosses that we're liked and listening and not wasting our time out here is really greatly appreciated. So, I mean, even if you've read our stories, go click on them again because that would really help us out. And leave it for a while so it makes it look like you're reading the whole thing. Don't just click on it. But, I mean, if you just want to click on it, do it. But scroll, do all that, and leave it open for a while so it looks like you're really engaged and enjoying it. Because, you know, I like being paid. John likes being paid. And we appreciate that you can do that. Tuesday's CDOT shows will be coming out, and we'll be back with you next week when it will be 2 weeks to open it. So, we're getting there.